Today, we're exploring the frontiers of what we know now about how psychosocial stress can make us physically ill before our time.
You're living in poor housing conditions. You might also be quite stressed out and that you feel out of control and you feel like you don't have much mastery over your environment, which is a stressful thing.
So we're not just taking stress by itself, we're seeing and what else associated with that, which includes material deprivation.
How healthy we are in part depends on the many different exposures we've had over our life. Exposure to chemicals, to physical, psychological, social factors, and some we're not even aware of. It really is a fascinating field, and with the advent of AI, better data linkage, genomics, and supercomputing, more links between exposures and ill health will surely be found in future. So with me to discuss, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Michelle Kelly Irving, the life course epidemiologist working on health inequalities and the social determinants of health. And she's a director at INSERM in Toulouse. And she's joined by Professor Nish Chaturvedi, who is Professor of Clinical Epidemiology at University College London and Chief of the MRC Unit for Lifelong Health and Ageing. Now, Nish has long studied the causes and mechanisms of disease and has a specific focus on ethnic minorities. Welcome both. So the first question I think really is, what is psychosocial stress? What are we talking about here? Nish?
So it encompasses both acute adverse events, things like bereavement, and the chronic strain that result from things like income insecurity or familial discord.
When you say chronic, how long a period would that sort of be? Anything beyond 1 to 2 weeks?
Oh, it could be lifelong, for example. And it could be also that, because of this wide definition, it's ubiquitous in all our lives and probably most of us are juggling multiple stresses.
And Michelle, can you add to that? Can you give any more examples about what we're talking about here and what might be the most injuring social stresses?
It would maybe distinguish between the stressor, so the thing that's causing our brain to interpret something as a stressful situation, versus the stress response, which is sort of how our body is responding based on the brain's action to relieve or to deal with the stressor that's happening. And maybe distinguishing between those things can be helpful because, then we can really talk about what those stressors are when we're talking about psychosocial stress. And as Nish was saying, that they're really quite varied. But I would add to that that there are, there's a lot of evidence now on things like adverse childhood experiences. So where there's maybe neglect or abuse going on, those are considered to be psychosocial stressors. Work conditions as well. Can you decide when you start work, when you end it, or is it really constrained? So all of those would be potential stressors that could be interpreted as psychosocial stressors, and that might induce a physiological stress response, which could be acute or could end up being chronic.
And we all know, don't we, that some people respond to stress, the same stress, in different ways. And do we know anything about the sort of archetypes, in a sense, of how people respond to external stresses that could be equal?
Shall I start, Jennifer, with some of the laboratory work, which I think is quite interesting, where they've tried to recapitulate acute stresses using things like a mental arithmetic test or a public speaking challenge, and explored what happens to the physiological stress response. This is governed by the brain. The brain is in charge of ensuring a stable internal environment in the face of external change. So simple changes like, for example, getting out of bed in the morning require complex corrective homeostatic responses that stop you collapsing because your blood pressure has fallen quite rapidly as a response of getting out of bed. So what they've done is to look at both the autonomic nervous system that controls heart rate and blood pressure and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that controls secretion of particular key hormones, including cortisol. And what they've shown in response to an acute stressor within the lab is that you have a marked uptick in these responses, almost in anticipation of the stressful event, followed by quite a rapid decline as you embark on the task and master it. And for many people, if you repeat exposure to that stressor, they become habituated. In other words, the stress response becomes more muted as you recognize that you can overcome the challenge relatively easily. For some people, though, they don't become habituated. It's almost like they're meeting that same stressor for the first time. So that is viewed as an abnormal response. Other abnormal responses include a persistently elevated response once the stressor has been removed, or indeed a blunted response in the first place, which may be due to suboptimal development of these stress responses. In terms of how that translates into personality types and behaviours, there are people who seem to be able to, as you say, cope better with stressful situations. And that's likely due to early life influences, upbringing, social networks, and those people respond therefore in better ways to a stressful response. But whether those people have the more beneficial physiological responses is not so clear.
Just turning to Michelle, I was reading a paper, I think it was one of the original papers on something called allostatic load, which I know you've written a lot about. And it had these sort of four stages of response to stress. One is the basal position is something called homeostasis. Then the response and habituation to sort of life stresses, which is kind of normal, if you like, which I think is allostasis, is that right? And then those can accumulate into an allostatic load over time. And then there is something called allostatic overload, which is where I think your responses are blunted and you cannot, because of too much accumulation of stress, you can't respond adequately. Is that a correct sort of characterization of some of the literature in this area?
The basic idea around allostatic load is when you're exposed repeatedly to stressors in your environment and you're interpreting these as being stressful conditions, and the brain is sort of telling many of its physiological systems to sort of get ready and respond to this stressful environment in order to act. And of course, this is a survival mechanism. This has allowed us to cope with our environments and get out of our stressful or bad situations. But of course, if that response remains at a high level, it doesn't come down to the normal basal level, or in fact, after a while, that basal level itself is altered upwards. Then you start to see a sort of erosion of the different physiological systems measured, you know, and so in the allostatic load model, we tend to use biochemical biomarkers to measure this. But the real idea behind it is to try and capture how there's a wear and tear that occurs across physiological systems over time. And that kind of links into the chronic question. So when you're really seeing that the physiological stress response is remaining at a level where you're soliciting those different organs and systems of your body in a way that it shouldn't normally be, well, after a while, it takes its toll on the body. And I think that's where we can start talking about allostatic load. And then, yes, you can end up in situations where perhaps people become non-responsive and so on. But a lot of the work on allostatic load is about, you know, population groups who find themselves with wear and tear across multiple systems over time.
Yes. And can you just unpack what exactly is going on in the body in the response to stress?
It starts in the brain. Your brain is interpreting something. And at the level of the brain, there are hormones being released into the body. So you have cortisol being released. And your brain is sort of controlling these neuroendocrine responses of releasing things into the body to tell other organs to do things or to tell other biological systems to do things. And so you get a cascade of responses down through different peripheral body systems. For example, you'll get an increase in blood glucose levels circulating in the body. And the idea, I think, there from an evolutionary point of view is to sort of provide energy to the body to respond to what's going on. Your heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up again to pump around the body, all these things that you need to respond. Of course, we can feel that, like when we feel stressed, we can feel that kind of adrenaline rush, and our heart rate goes up. And this is just like our body is ready to respond.
Nish, what would you add to that?
The challenge here is finding objective evidence that supports these theories. So I've talked about acute stresses in the laboratory, which are relatively but not so simple to perform and understand. But as Michelle talked about, what happens in the chronic setting? So for that, we have to take population samples, ask them about their exposure to stresses, and measure some of these biomarkers that Michelle talked about. And there's no real consensus about which measures you should be capturing. So for example, cortisol. People measure urinary cortisol. They measure the morning cortisol response or the plateaued cortisol response in the evening or the difference between the morning and evening response. There's no consensus about which of those is right. And when you look at outcomes in association with these various responses, the literature is somewhat mixed and inconsistent, that some measures are associated with adverse health events and some are not. And in humans, it's difficult to disentangle the effect of stress on these physiological response mechanisms to other downstream consequences of stress. So, for example, it's clear that people who are experiencing stress, be it acute or chronic, may adopt adverse health behaviours, take up smoking, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, adverse diets. And these we know for sure impact health. So is it acting through health behaviours mainly or exclusively? It's really not quite clear.
So just say that you see lots of a response and you don't quite know whether the response is due to the behavioural or some other inherent psychosocial stress. How does that then lead to disease? Let's take cardiovascular disease, because Nish, I know you're an expert in that.
The short answer is we really don't know, because a whole series of inflammatory, metabolic, vascular responses occur as a consequence of stress, of the adverse health behaviours that are associated with that. So they all act together to act on the vessel wall, for example, or to act on vascular function, to produce thickened walls, maybe plaque, you know, the things that narrow blood vessels that may lead to, say, a cardiovascular event. But it's really hard for us to tease out the mechanisms for each, you know, from stress through, say, a particular mechanisms like cortisol response or the autonomic system to outcomes. There is some evidence that a repeated elevated blood pressure response to, for example, a stressor may result in elevated 24-hour blood pressures. We know blood pressure leads to stiffening of arteries, to atheroma. Tease out a mechanism through that.
And Michelle, would you add anything?
It's really difficult to disentangle what's coming through the behaviours. So we know that probably these stressors are leading people to take up behaviours that are probably less good for their health. And to what extent is that pulling, again, towards these systems becoming worn out over time?
Jennifer, you mentioned cardiovascular disease as an example, and I think that's a really interesting example in this domain, that currently there is a marked social gradient in cardiovascular disease. People who are less well off have higher rates of cardiovascular disease, and stress has been invoked as perhaps the mechanism to account for that. But when we look back a century ago, there was also a social gradient in cardiovascular disease, but it was the other way around. It was the more affluent folk who had higher rates of cardiovascular disease. And again, stress was invoked as the explanation, largely through occupational terms, where people said, it's the stress of striving, it's the type A personality, it's the white collar worker who has considerable autonomy and considerable flexibility in the way they operate. And it's that striving that increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. And then that explanation has been reversed now that the gradient has been reversed. So we still talk about stress causing or explaining the social gradient in cardiovascular disease. But now for the people who are less well off, and say, again, through occupational terms, it's loss of control, it's loss of autonomy that's driving that association. And it's interesting that both groups invoke the same physiological stress mechanisms, but the upstream sort of determinants are somewhat different. And I'm just to emphasize, that's not to deny that stress is an important factor in health and that there are social inequalities. It's whether stress per se explains those social inequalities.
Very interesting point. Are there certain diseases that are more uncovered? I mean, cardiovascular disease we've mentioned, but are there other candidates for being almost a population marker of stress? Or is that just a far too simple way of thinking about things?
Well, the most striking example is the Great Depression, where suicides markedly increased, the degree of mental distress markedly increased. But actually, overall health indices improved during that period of marked economic recession. And this includes health events, mortality, and life expectancy. So cardiovascular disease event rates actually went down during that period. And it was during the periods of boom, if anything, that we see an escalation of cardiovascular events. So some people talk about a latency effect. Some people say, well, in periods of recession, people are not able to indulge in adverse health behaviours like smoking. They simply can't afford it, whereas in boom times, they can. So it's quite a complex picture. And I think it's probably quite context specific. And even when we look at the most recent economic recession around 2008, again, we see fairly immediate effects on mental health, but less consistent effects on other health metrics.
If there's a latent period, then is there evidence of a shadow later on, like a decade later, that something big happened, a rock was thrown into population health from some massive stressor that we then see 10 years later?
There is evidence of quite a long-term effect, and you know, it does come from this idea of there being a long shadow cast. But one thing I would say with regards to the relationship between stress and health, to pull into what Nish was saying before about it being something that's observed across the social gradient, but perhaps the number of things that are stressing us might be quite different. And those material circumstances that, of course, expose us to lots of other health hazards. You know, you're living in poor housing conditions, you might be breathing in molds or other things that you in that environment that are bad for your health. But you might also be quite stressed out by the fact that your landlord is not responding to your calls to get that sorted out, and that you feel out of control and you feel like you don't have much mastery over your environment, which is a stressful thing. So actually the combination of those things are quite difficult to untangle, and they may be accumulating more in members of society who are in more disadvantaged social circumstances or experiencing discriminations.
Yes, I was reading something by someone called Gustafsson from Sweden, who talked about the signature of stress, which was the effect on the body of accumulation of exposures over the life course. Is that contentious, or is there enough evidence to show that there is a kind of mark on us all of things we've experienced?
Every living organism responds to its environment. That's how we survive, how we adapt to our environments. And I work using the concept of embodiment, which is how our physical bodies, the cells, the organisms, the physiological systems of our bodies, respond to the environment in which we're living in, and that environment is socially structured. It's not really surprising to then see that physiological parameters of our bodies might follow a social gradient, seeing as our environment is socially patterned. In some ways, you could just see it as we're adapting to our environments. In some ways, it is not contentious, but I suppose if you start pulling it towards only seeing it as negative, it becomes a little bit more contentious from that point of view. But again, for me, it comes back to these structures that we can maybe alter it as a society. So making sure that people are provided with the material circumstances that might allow them to then cope with their stressors a little bit more easily in terms of emotional regulation. I'm a parent. It's much more difficult to be a patient, calm and warm parent if you've got to deal with 50 million things and the car broke down and the boiler's on the blink and granny has fallen over and I need to sort her out. And if you're dealing with all that, it's much harder to provide those kind of relational environments that we know are beneficial.
Yes, and that kind of brings me to asking Nish a bit more about almost cultural protective factors, particularly, you know, as different communities provide different levels of social support culturally. I don't know whether this has come up in your analysis of ethnicity and the differences between ethnic groups and how certain factors, maybe psychosocial factors in those communities, can be protective or not against stressors like deprivation.
So Michelle has very elegantly articulated the really complex relationships between various factors around health outcomes. And one of the things it does, it makes it really challenging to disentangle different contributions. But studying people in different settings, at different time points, or indeed, as you're saying, Jennifer, different cultural beliefs and values, really helps us to try and disentangle these effects. So you're right that there are different cultural approaches, if you like, to familial arrangements, the sort of South Asian view of multiple generations living together, supporting each other with childcare and caring for older adults, that can also be quite stressful for particular individuals in that if the relationship is discordant. And Michelle talked about embodiments, you know, this idea of how we embody the external environment to change our internal environment and maybe result in either prolonged health or disease. And I think that's a really nice theoretical construct to understand the multiplicity of these environmental exposures.
Just on a small niche area, epigenetics and how stress can affect DNA and the extent to which that can be transmitted to future generations. Where are we with evidence on that and how should we understand it?
There is evidence from animal studies and also from some observational cohort studies that certain epigenetic effects may be transmitted from parents to children. So children whose mothers or fathers have been exposed and have these epigenetic modifications, there has been some evidence showing that the offspring have these modifications as well. I would say we're still in the early stages, and I would be a bit reluctant to go much further than just describing that kind of research as it is for now. But perhaps Nish has some other insights.
So Jennifer, you talked about transgenerational effects, and we do see those. How do they occur? Well, they can occur broadly in around three ways. That it could occur as a consequence of exposure in utero. So the classic example is maternal smoking and the impact it has on the child's health. So that is an example of transgenerational transmission. There's also behavioural transfer. So in other words, the child of a parent who smokes is much more likely to become a smoker themselves because of this behavioural transfer. And they too will recapitulate those epigenetic changes in response to that environmental stressor on gene expression. And then there's true germline transfer. And I think the evidence for that latter is much less clear in human studies, clearer perhaps in animals, but less so in humans.
Which then leads me on to perhaps the thinking about the future and the frontiers of research. I wonder if you could both sort of say something about where you think the frontiers are and what's exciting you about future areas of research in this area that could really make transparent some of the maybe causative or even associative relations between some of these many factors that can impact on health.
Very exciting area, and as you rightly identify, that we have major advances in data availability and in its depth and our ability to capture data. So, for example, remote testing and wearables allows us to capture stressors much more accurately than we ever used to, with continuous readouts of the physiological stress response, such as heart rate, blood pressure, glucose, and associated health-related variables such as sleep patterns and exercise. And we are better able to capture the end phenotype. So, for example, at the moment, we've talked about health events like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and so on. But increasingly, with non-invasive technology, with imaging, we can capture quite subtle changes in target organs. And a really good exemplar of this approach is the US ABCD study. And in America, they've set up the study called the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, recruiting children across the country aged 9 to 10 and performing every 2 years, structural and functional brain imaging. They're capturing measures of early life stresses, behaviors, parenting approaches, social networks, and measuring the very subtle impact that that has on brain structure and function, and outcomes like cognition, mental health, cardiovascular measures, glucose, and so on. So we can really get at that very important phase of life that Michelle was talking about. What are the determinants of optimal brain structure and function? What are the determinants of optimal physiological stress responses? And what are the optimal determinants of psychological coping strategies in that very young age group? And AI approaches can then help us to understand the effects of these stresses within the context of the wider exposome. So we're not just taking stress by itself, we're seeing, and what else associated with that, which includes material deprivation, on these complex interrelated biological mechanisms and their associations with multiple outcomes. And AI can help us detect patterns that hypothesis-driven research may well miss. So I think this is a really exciting time.
I feel very optimistic about this ability we have now to collect so much data. We have the ability now to collect samples quite well now remotely, so we don't need to be quite so invasive. We can, you know, look at all sorts of things now using people's hair, for example, or taking dried blood spots and picking up biomarkers, which means that people don't have to come to clinics, they don't have to come in. And so we maybe have a bit more of a chance of picking up what's going on across the whole breadth of the population, because of course we have the problem in science, which is that the types of people who come and join our studies tend to be usually quite well-off people or well-resourced people. So if we really want to know what's going on across all the breadth and depth of the population, these methods of collecting things remotely are actually really important. And so the area that I'm most interested in is the build-up phase, so it's the childhood and the adolescent phases. And I think we could, we could really use those new technologies now to do some interesting repeated measures, where we can start to see when do these socioeconomic patterns, other social differences start to emerge, and start thinking about what could be done about them from a social point of view, from our societal, from our policy perspective. Maybe we can even do some simulation using these data to imagine a educational environment or a schooling environment, and how would it affect or reverse some effects. So I think there's a huge ream of possibilities there, but I would like to see us doing research on how the big social structures we have, like education, housing policies, how are they likely to potentially change these embodiment processes, and therefore what choices could we make from a point of view to improve everyone's health?
What can we do to ameliorate the situation given the evidence that we have now, and given of course constrained resources, which are a feature of life in Britain, particularly public sector resources? You know, if you think of what Michael Marmot was suggesting, and he had a long list of recommendations on how to reduce inequalities in health, much of which was really reducing environmental stress, you know, from relieving poverty to early life support, good jobs for everyone, etc., etc. Is there anything more that you would be able to add, given the state of the literature, on how best to target resources and to make things better in future?
If I'm honest, I'm not sure that AI is going to reveal any more about the fact that we know that poverty and inequality are bad for your health. We might learn more about specifics, but I think the literature and the evidence on that has been pretty consistent for such a long time. And as you say, you know, Michael Marmot and many other people have made recommendations as to potential ways in which to deal with social inequality, to deal with discrimination, to deal with poverty, and so on. And my feeling, and maybe I'm moving a little bit away from the evidence here, but is that is more evidence required in order to know what to do? I would question that. I think there's a lot of evidence out there. I don't live in the UK anymore, but it would seem like maybe reversing the erosion of these public sector funding structures that has been going on for a while is a major area that could be looked into to try and reduce inequalities, which have been increasing over time, and to try and confront what's going on with life expectancy, which is dropping off now. And that's largely, at least, many of the UK scholars are pointing towards inequality as being the driver for that.
Yes. And given, you know, one would want all of Marmot's recommendations to be acted on, that can't happen because of the resource constraints. Where is the priority given the evidence? Is it really in early life? Is it in teenage health? Or would you really go for the mid-age males where life expectancy is dropping off the most in deprived communities?
Obviously, ideally, you'd want to address all of those things. And it's about, you know, priorities. You know, you say there is money, it's just that, you know, it's not seen as a priority, despite the wealth of evidence that material deprivation has adverse consequences and social inequalities underpinning those. And yet, despite the repeat observations, we're not acting. Do we need more evidence? Perhaps if we were to show underlying mechanisms that would add to the body of evidence to persuade policymakers to intervene. In terms of when, if you had to choose, I would choose early life. Clearly for policymakers, that's not particularly attractive because you have to wait many years for those outcomes to be apparent. And where research can help perhaps is to identify surrogate endpoints, surrogate measures of much later life health events to say, yes, it's had an impact. I can see at the age of 5 or at the age of 10, this is going to have an impact. So research is still required to understand the impact of the kind of interventions that Michelle was talking about.
And this podcast actually has examined the lack of long-term policy making and the reasons for that, and how, in a sense, investing in health capital, which is the phrase of the time, is really a 20 to 30 year sort of investment, like climate change, isn't it?
Exactly. And I completely agree with Nish. I think that that is one of the reasons why you don't see a policy focus there, is that if you're intervening in early life, it's really very difficult to see with a kind of strong evidence measures the improvements, because it takes such a long time to see them, first of all. And second of all, the longer the time, the more all these other confounding factors, as we call it in epidemiology, come into it. So it is very difficult to actually kind of prove the impact of those investments in early life. But what I would argue is that investing in early life is important for the whole life course, but it's also just important for children, right? We talk about how it's important because it creates a population with longevity and that's stronger and more resilient and so on. But it's also a question of, you know, injustice and equity in childhood.
It's a moral question, isn't it?
Exactly. Rather than it's a moral question.
You know, it's not that government doesn't introduce policies to improve our lot. You know, the Sure Start programme was, I think, a great example. What's missing is a really systematic approach to evaluation across the spectrum of health, social and economic status. You know, we're having a lot of missed opportunities here where we could have really understood the impact of particular interventions on multiple health outcomes.
So we must leave it there. Absolutely fascinating, I hope you agree, and a topic we will surely return to. Thanks as always to our guests, Michelle Kelly-Irving and Nish Chaturvedi, for their insights today. And for more information on the topics, please go to our show notes where we've put some of the publications that give some more detail for your interest. Next month, we will be turning our sights back to the National Health Service, particularly in the run-up to the 75th anniversary in July, and we'll be looking at future aspects of care. So join us then. Meantime, thank you for listening. Thanks to Kate Addison and Leo Eubank at the Health Foundation and Paddy at Mold Productions. And goodbye until next time from me, Jennifer Dixon.